evening, everybody. Please be seated. Welcome, everybody in the courtroom to our new facility. We're very proud to be here today. This is our second day of oral arguments, and this is our final case for our en banc oral arguments this week. This is case number 69969992, Fredinelli versus Martinez. Ms. Moore for the appellant, Ms. Price for the respondent. Ms. Moore.
Good morning. Justices, I'm Chief Justice Cherry. Patricia Moore appearing on behalf of appellant, Christy Fredinelli. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time, if I may.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. This case involves an attorney's lien that was subsequently reduced to a monetary judgment in a paternity action. And specifically, I think we can all agree, based on the respondent's answering brief, that it was a retaining lien. And the question, the crux of the argument is, what do, under NRS 18.015, subsection 6, what does it mean to enforce a lien when it's a retaining lien? There's abundant authority in this regard that there's a distinction between a retaining lien and a charging lien. The respondent, and the reason that we argued in our opening brief that it's a charging lien is, what else could it be when you reduce something to a monetary judgment, when you reduce fees to a monetary judgment that's collectible by any and all legal means with statutory interest? A retaining lien is a different creature, as this court has stated and ordered in numerous cases. A retaining lien gives an attorney the right to retain property, such as a case file, in that attorney's possession, not reduced to a monetary judgment at the distinction which a charging lien provides for. In that regard, there are some nuances in this case. The respondent relied upon a credit card authorization as a purported agreement, and that credit card authorization, if the court will note, is from a third party that's not even a party to this case. So without getting into the merits of due process at this point, if it acts like a duck and looks like a duck, it's a duck. And so when you reduce something to a monetary judgment, that duck has to be a charging lien, not a retaining lien. So it's a little convoluted, but if we go with respondents' argument that it's a retaining lien, this court has been abundantly clear the distinctions between the two types of liens, and there was no due process provided to the third party or our client, because it states it's a retaining lien. And we reserved it, the court will note, in our opposition to the motion to reduce or to enforce and adjudicate the lien, we reserved the right to dispute the fees because some of them were duplicative. But the bottom line is, this court would have to overrule Argentina. It would have to overrule Leventhal.
Maybe precede your question, but Leventhal, why is Leventhal still applicable based upon the change in the law?
Well, if it's a charging lien, it is applicable. And if it was reduced to a money judgment, then even though they're calling it a retaining lien, in essence, it's a charging lien. So that's when Leventhal would be applicable, because in Leventhal, this honorable court stated that there's timeliness factors, there isn't any tangible property. That was a post-divorce case where the appellant was seeking to obtain monies. There were some visitation issues, and this court ordered there isn't any tangible recovery from which there could be a monetary recovery. So this court denied the relief. Did that answer your question?
It answered my question. I'm still having problems with the use of Leventhal in light of the change in the statute.
You know, it's your characterization that this is a charging lien. Clearly, it was posted up as a retaining lien. Okay, and you're saying, no, it's really not.
It's a charging lien, and therefore Leventhal applies. And then after the amendment to 18015, you know, I'd like to hear your take on how that affected retaining liens in general.
Retaining liens? I would submit to the court that it's still, this court has said time and time again that a retaining lien is a passive lien. That's how this court has characterized it. So how does a passive lien turn into a monetary judgment? The statutes, I'm clear, but given NRS subsection 6, it should refer to the different statutes. There are subparts A that deal with the charging lien, subparts B, which deal with the retaining lien. So it's certainly a leap to make to say that previously, this court previously ruled that to enforce a retaining lien, you have to post security to obtain that paperwork or the file back or any property that the attorney is holding, not reduce it to a money judgment. That's significant. That's a great.
What about 1801552? Can you address that just briefly?
Okay, for a reasonable fee, I would submit to the court that could be the value of the retaining lien and what it would cost and the security that you would have to post. But given the precedent that this court has set, I would state to the court, specifically characterizing a retaining lien as a passive lien.
But again, what you're talking about a charging lien, and a retaining lien is a passive lien because there's no monetary judgment for which the lien to attach. But when you look at 18015 subsection 2, that seems to contradict your argument that whether or not there is a money judgment or not, the attorney is entitled to the service provided.
Well, I would submit that in Argentina, this court specifically said that attorney can take other independent measures to collect those fees.
What's the time limit? And is it limited to the subject matter under this statute? In other words, a client has an agreement with an attorney that the client's going to pay for a couple of different things, pieces of legal work, and the lawyer has files. One of them has litigation involved. Client's just the lawyer, and 2 years passes. How does this retaining lien statute work? Can the lawyer just say, I like this judge, I'm going to file a motion to adjudicate this lien, and I still have 10 pages of paper from the client, I'm going to retain it, and the client says, I don't even want my file back, go away. Can the lawyer, under this statute, go into court and have it adjudicated and a judgment entered?
I would submit to the court that answer would be no, that there are other forms in which this attorney can redress the fees that are owed to the attorney.
But read literally, this statute would permit that, right?
Not on a retaining lien, no. Not based on precedent and...
Well, I understand on the precedent, but the reading of the amendment seems to me to say that's okay. So all of a sudden courts are going to summarily adjudicate liens long after the file's over?
Not adjudicate liens, but again, the attorney would utilize perhaps file an independent action for the fees. And I know the statute is...
It allows that. I mean, it's a contract dispute at that point that you owe me money and you haven't paid and I'm going to sue you. Right? I mean.
Correct. But in this case, the distinction in this case is that it's a retaining lien and not a charging lien. So the retaining lien specifically states that we can keep that in possession, and there isn't any guidance when it says enforce the lien. I guess that's a question of the day. What does it mean to enforce the lien?
What if the client says, keep my papers, I don't want them?
That's fine, and then the attorney would have to file an independent action to collect those fees. Or perhaps file an action in district court specifically seeking the fees, but not stating, I'm filing a motion to enforce my retaining lien.
But here the client said they opposed the enforcement of the retaining lien, right?
I'm sorry?
In this case, your client opposed the enforcement of the retaining lien.
Opposed the enforcement? No, opposed...
They joined issue on it, right?
Because she was... If the respondent was asking for monetary judgment, and so we did oppose that. And when then the court ordered a monetary judgment, even though the respondent stated, I'm seeking to enforce my retaining lien, not obtain a monetary judgment.
You have less than 5 minutes left. If you want to reserve...
I will. Thank you.
Ms. Price.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may I please report? My name is Corinne Price, and I represent Fine and Price Law Group in this action, which is now presently the firm of Fine, Harmon, and Price. The only issue identified on appeal and in the arguments below by Ms. Fredianelli is whether the district court erred in entering a monetary judgment in a paternity custody action upon which no charging lien could attach. To be clear, no charging lien has ever been asserted in this case. No charging lien has ever been adjudicated in this case. This is not a charging lien case. The retaining lien enacted by NRS 18015 and asserted by the Fine and Price Law Group was a separate and distinct type of lien from a charging lien, specifically created by the legislature with the specific purpose of superseding the common law passive retaining lien that Ms. Moore was speaking about earlier, and with the specific clearly stated intent of increasing judicial efficiency, minimizing duplicative civil actions and the possibility of disparate results between two different courtrooms, improving access to justice for working class poor litigants in our system, ensuring that fee disputes between client and attorney are resolved expeditiously and by the judicial officer who has the most knowledge and insight regarding the reasonableness and nature of those fees that were incurred. Based upon the district court's findings that the fine and prices retaining lien was properly served, it was properly noticed, it was properly perfected, and it was properly adjudicated pursuant to this new statute, NRS 18015-1B, we request that the district court's decision be affirmed. Addressing the question of what does it mean to enforce the attorney lien, I believe we need to turn to the plain, exact language of the statutory authority. As was noted by the court, subsection 2 clearly refers to the adjudication of fees, how much is owed by the client to the attorney. And
where in the statute does it say that a monetary judgment enforceable against the party like any other judgment without reference to the liened property is permissible?
It doesn't specifically state, Your Honor, that a monetary judgment can be entered against the client. However, the two key words of the statute are adjudicate and enforce. So we're looking at adjudication of the amount of fees that are owed.
Where in the statute can this judgment be enforced against anything other than the retained file?
I believe that would be in Section 2 of the statute, Your Honor, where it talks about the specific adjudication of the fees owed.
But paragraph 2, following up on Justice Hardesty's question, I hope I didn't cut you off, Justice Hardesty.
No.
It talks about the amount of the lien. So the court could adjudicate what's the amount against the retained file. But if the client says, I don't want my file, I don't want anything more to do with you, don't bother me, and the client says that to the court, is there a retaining lien for the court to adjudicate? A and B, can the court convert that into a personal money judgment in this setting? As I understand it, you read the statute to say yes, the court can.
I do, Your Honor.
And where's the language that authorizes that?
I believe that would be the enforced language. If we adjudicate a fee dispute, we arrive at Subsection 2's specific numerical value of the money due and owing between the lawyer and the client, then what does the word enforce mean?
without that key word in the statute.
Why wouldn't it mean enforcement against the property to which the lien attaches? That's how liens work. Mechanics liens, almost any lien in our law. The debt becomes a lien against the property. So, under your reading of the statute, why wouldn't the enforcement of the lien be against the retained file? As opposed to a monetary judgment that becomes enforceable as if it were a general judgment.
I believe that to enforce a money judgment clearly means to be able to go ahead and enforce the numerical value of adjudication of fees necessarily means to go ahead with the monetary judgment. In the event there's any questions of ambiguity in the statute or multiple interpretation, I think at that point we must look to the public policy behind the statute.
And then can you double up? Can you have, I was asking your friend on the other side this question, but can you double up and say a lawyer is performing multiple services for a client, which often happens, some of which are related to the litigation, others of which are not. Is it your reading that that entire dispute can be brought in under 18015 in a personal money judgment rendered?
I do believe that the statute permits that, Your Honor.
Okay. And then going further, can this be accomplished a year after the case is over?
Answering the two parts of those questions, if I may, the first one would be going to the timing. The first one would be going to the timing of when you can bring a lawsuit. The public policy, the stated intent of creating this corrective legislation regarding retaining liens was due to the fact that without the ability of an expedited process to resolve these disputes and obtain a money judgment, there's a dramatic increase in pro per litigants in our system. We had attorneys who were requiring substantial upfront retainers to begin the litigation because they couldn't be sure that at the end of the case, when their services were no longer needed, that they would actually be paid. At the same time, we have these working parents who have serious custody issues that need to be resolved.
I'm not disagreeing with the policy. I'm just trying to understand under this statute, a year after the case is over, can I, in your reading of this statute as the lawyer, ask the court to adjudicate a retaining lien as to a file the client doesn't want back?
Absolutely.
And obtain a personal money judgment against the client?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And what about 5 years later?
I believe that the statute of limitations would apply,
okay,
as would any other contract action agreement between two individuals. That necessity and the reason that this retaining lien statute is so special and unique in this case is because attorney liens are a special and separate creature. There's very few other contract disputes or money judgments that are requested to be enforced that have such public policy concerns and that require the intense scrutiny of a judicial officer to determine if those fees are reasonable. We have the family court judge, in typical family court cases, already going through that analysis, the Brunzell analysis, where they have to determine the factors. Are the fees requested reasonable? Are the legal questions at issue unique? What are the qualities of the advocate? What was actually done and was it was necessary in this case?
Ms. Price, wasn't that the stated intent of the legislature in amending this statute? As I understand it, the record made before the Assembly Judiciary Committee states that the purpose of the statute was to allow the judge who heard the case to interpret how the fees would be awarded.
Yes, sir.
But there's nothing in there that talks about how the enforcement of the judgment would change. And what you're advocating, essentially, is that the statute should be read to convert all of the attributes of a charging lien or retaining lien to a charging lien. I don't see that in the legislative history at all. Do you?
I actually do, Your Honor.
Okay.
Senator Sugarbloom, in the Assembly minutes on the meeting for the judiciary, specifically talked about the inability of attorneys to collect their fees at the end of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what was driving the increase in pro per litigants, especially before the family court.
Mm-hmm.
So having an expedited process where an attorney could be secure
that their fees would actually be paid was a key component and a key purpose of the statute.
Could you address another point in this statute for me that gave me pause? It's subparagraph 5, and I'll read it. It says a lien pursuant to paragraph B1 of subsection 1, which is the retaining lien we've been talking about, must not be construed as inconsistent with the attorney's professional responsibilities to the client. When I read that, it seems to me to be saying that we as the court system charged with overseeing professional conduct cannot say that a lawyer who has unethically asserted a retaining lien against his client's files, and he knows the client needs those files to go to trial, that we as the courts cannot count that as an ethical offense. Do you read that subparagraph the same way?
No, Your Honor, I read it very differently.
Okay.
I read that as a safeguard for the public. At common law, at retaining liens, you could withdraw prior to the trial going forward in the case, for example, and you could hold that client file to prejudice the underlying case.
But there's ethics rules that say you cannot.
Exactly. So during the discussion and in the assembly minutes from the discussion of the statute, they permitted, if you look at subsection B, and I believe it's subsection 4, where you can just retain one piece of paper. You can retain just a copy of the client's file and the pleadings and turn everything over. Now, at common law, that would extinguish the retaining law, the retaining lien that the client has. But they specifically provided for that in the statute so that there would be no inconsistencies between a lawyer's ethical obligations to the client, but also secure the retaining lien so it wouldn't be extinguished and there would still be guaranteed the payment at the second.
Subparagraph 5 says the assertion of a retaining lien must not be construed as inconsistent with the attorney's professional obligation. It doesn't say that the client or the lawyer asserting the retaining lien must not violate the rules of professional responsibility. It seems to be saying the courts must not construe the assertion of the lien as a violation of professional responsibility. There's a difference.
I agree. My interpretation of that, and perhaps that's just based more upon an in-depth reading of the history and the discussion surrounding the statute, it was to guarantee that we could turn over the file and could comply with all of our ethical obligations to the client without fear of having our retaining lien extinguished.
So your interpretation of the statute is that you can give the file up, but you still get to prosecute a retaining lien against a file that you no longer hold. Is that your position?
As long as you have something of the client's, whether that be your attorney's notes, something in the file, perhaps your client has given you their baby book, if it's a custody.
Well, I'm just going to pose that as a hypothetical. I'm glad you brought up that subject. Oftentimes, when I did some family law cases, I get a bunch of letters from the client that they had exchanged with their spouse, usually to use as information that could be developed during the course of the case. So if I provide the file back to the client, but I retain all the letters, does that provide a basis for retaining lien?
Pursuant to the statute, what would, Your Honor?
But if I don't give the client back the letters, haven't I committed an ethical violation?
I believe that perhaps this is an additional reason why that section 5 was included there. It's my understanding that you can merely make a copy of those, and those documents that remain in your possession are symbolic. They are what the retaining lien is supposed to attach to meet competing balances of the public policy concerns of making sure that litigants, especially in the family court system, have access to justice, while at the same time making sure that attorneys preserve the rights to get paid on a family law or other act of case.
But this statute is not limited to the family law setting. By its terms, it would apply to a multi-million dollar commercial dispute as well. So a lawyer who feels his or her client has failed to pay in full and the client is disputing the reasonableness of the fee, that lawyer under this statute, equally with the family law lawyer, can go and ask for a summary adjudication, and in your reading of the statute, obtain a personal judgment transportable across the country against the client who didn't pay the lawyer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And lawyers have always had that action. We have always had the opportunity to bring a separate and independent civil action without holding anything of the clients in a separate civil court.
Right, but my point is this statute would let you do it in the action in which the claim was adjudicated.
And I would submit that that's the most appropriate court to hear the dispute. They are the court that's already familiar with the underlying facts and circumstances of the case. They know what the lawyer did in the case, what was necessary to adjudicate the client's right.
Does this statute permit a retained criminal defense lawyer to go back to the judge who adjudicated the criminal case and award the fees and impose a judgment against the defendant who's been acquitted?
I believe the statute says specifically in any civil action, Your Honor. The reason that this is so important in family court proceedings is because the family court is already doing this already. In almost every single family court proceeding, the judge is already making a decision on the fees. We have a required financial disclosure form where we have a whole section dedicated to how much fees have been paid, how many fees have been incurred, and other...
What fees charge?
So the court is already conducting detailed Miller v. Wilfong analysis, Brenzell analysis on fees back and forth already. To ask a second court that's unfamiliar with proceedings to duplicate that work and the potential for disparate results between the two was deemed a waste of valuable judicial resources and unnecessary.
What if the client asserts a malpractice claim as a defense? Would this statute still entitle the award of fees and not assess or address the defense, the affirmative defense for malpractice?
I believe that issue was addressed in the Sports Surgeon Center decision, where it found that while the district court, pursuant to Langer, had authority to hear all disputes, it would certainly be more appropriate for the district court to defer that out to a separate
That was addressed where?
I believe that was in Argentina.
But the question is, how does that occur? How is that impacted by this statutory change? If the party in this case doesn't just object to the dollar amount, but asserts in addition, in response to the motion to enforce the retaining lien, a malpractice claim, does this judge still proceed, the family court judge still proceed with entering a judgment? And what becomes of the malpractice affirmative defense?
My understanding of Argentina is that this court has clearly directed the district court to separate that out and require the attorney and the client to address those issues in a separate civil action.
But what becomes of the motion to enforce the retaining lien? Is that to be transferred out too, or does this statute still mandate the judgment be entered nevertheless?
I would, in the interest of judicial efficiency, submit that all of that will be transferred to the second court if the retaining lien isn't addressed or adjudicated in that separate civil action and that issue is completed, then it may very well go back before the original district court.
Thank you, Ms. Bruce. Ms. Martin, you have 4 minutes and 42 seconds.
In rebuttal, I would submit that the statute and NRS 18.015, there's a reason that there are two subsections, A and B, and otherwise A and B would have been combined. There's a distinction for a reason, and specifically, property can mean much more than just the file itself, some letters or baby books. It can also mean monies held in a trust account. And so certainly, when the party seeking to enforce that lien sought to do that, it could retain monies that it may or may not have in the trust account as well. It's more than paperwork. It's more than a file. It could actually be money. And
Ms. Moore, isn't Ms. Price's definition of enforcement grounded in the legislative history?
I'm sorry?
Isn't Ms. Price's definition that she's asking of the enforcement, isn't that grounded in the legislative history? Where they contemplate that a judge could issue a judgment if they thought it was appropriate?
I would disagree. I would state that there's actually not only based upon the distinction of the subsections, but the actual name of the liens themselves, retaining, were not
retaining files, retaining money, property. There's a distinction between that and enforcing the lien. You're enforcing a retaining lien.
The question was, do we give any credence to that legislative history, or do we just ignore it? You seem to just want to ignore it.
I don't want to ignore it. I want to, maybe for purposes of this argument, but...
You wish it weren't there, yeah.
Yeah, it would be helpful, but the amendment to this statute, 18.015, is very clear. Enforce the lien.
Well, but it also says, I mean, this is problematic. Paragraph 6 says, on motion filed by an attorney having a lien under this section, and that's either 1A or 1B, it's not differentiated, the court shall, after 5 days' notice, adjudicate the rights of the attorney, client, or other parties and enforce the lien. So, your opponent seems to be arguing that you get the notice and you have the lien. The adjudication encompasses the dollar obligation stated, since under paragraph 2, the lien is for the reasonable fees without regard to the difference between 1A and 1B. And that's a plausible statutory interpretation of this. Now, there might be issues with respect to, is this fair to summon people into court on 5 days' notice? Is there an issuance of summons and process? There's, like, all kinds of issues. But read literally, the statute seems to support what she's saying. Would you agree with that or disagree with that?
No, I disagree.
Tell me why not.
I disagree because the distinction of the subsections themselves, the legislature went into painstaking detail to separate these. And sure, you can enforce maybe a charging lien, but it depends on how you're categorizing that lien. And the retaining lien, perhaps I can't stress that enough, it's to retain. Do I have money in the trust account? I'm going to retain it. Judge, please give me, an order enforcing that I keep the file, I keep the baby photos, and I keep the money that's in the trust account. Thank you for that adjudication. But that's why the separation is there, and then following that, the 4, 5, 6, and 7, depending on what character of lien you have, is how you enforce it. And again, the phrase of the day is, what does it mean to enforce a lien? What does it mean to enforce a retaining lien? We're going to keep everything. Attorney, counsel, you keep what you can retain, what you have in your possession. Do you have money in your trust account? Keep it. And then there's always a form. In Argentina, I know that the court ordered, because an attorney's retaining lien is a passive lien, the client determines whether it wants to extinguish the lien. Why would the court say that if it's okay to later on just get a monetary judgment?
Well, the statute was amended post-Argenta.
Right, and I agree with that. But this court clearly recognized, and perhaps that's implied dicta, that the court realized the distinction between the two types of lien and the importance of the collection in an independent action.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Thank you, Ms. Price, for your excellent arguments and briefs. This matter stands submitted and will recess to the court.